You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs, in for Carrie Miller. In this current climate of political divisiveness, it seems there's at least one issue that many Democrats and Republicans can agree on, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. President Obama has championed the trade agreement, which he says would boost trade between the U.S. and 11 other countries, while mandating that those countries beef up labor regulations and environmental protections. But numerous voices have come out in opposition to the TPP, saying it threatens the country's security and would unfairly benefit large corporations. Both presidential candidates Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have said they're against the TPP. Recently, liberal senator and former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders cheered on Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell when McConnell promised to block a vote on the trade agreement this year. Still, the TPP has already been fast-tracked by Congress, and President Obama has stated he hopes to push through a vote during the lame duck session post-election. This hour, we're going to take a closer look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership, what it entails, how much it could do for the American economy, and its chances moving forward. Joining me this hour is Usha Haley, professor of management at West Virginia University. She joins us from Morgantown, West Virginia. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes. And also joining us is U.S. economics editor for The Economist, Henry Kerr. He's in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Henry. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So first off, Usha Haley, why does President Obama want the Trans-Pacific Partnership so badly?
Well, I think because it's part of his legacy, and he does believe, perhaps, that it would stop the creeping of China into that region. And the second issue, I mean, I'm not sure about the first issue. I think it's a bit late to start establishing his legacy, but I seriously do not believe that it's going to stop China or stave off China's influence in that region.
So you would say that this is not necessarily going to be effective in the area of...
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. U.S. economics editor Henry Kerr, how exactly would the TPP affect trade?
Well, the TPP is not that like past trade deals. So when you think of past trade deals like the North American Free Trade Agreement, for instance, mm-hmm. what that was doing was mainly cutting tariffs. The kind of tax that's levied on imported goods, and so between Canada and Mexico and the United States, NAFTA cut those tariffs quite dramatically. But the TPP, while it does phase out a lot of tariffs, it's a lot about regulatory harmonization and removing what are called non-tariff barriers to trade to kind of increase trade in other ways. So it's quite different from past trade agreements in that respect, and a lot of the benefits flow from that.
Yeah, and a lot of people have said that it's getting to these sorts of trade agreements are getting increasingly complex as we move forward. Is that correct, Usha Haley?
Yes, it is. I mean, I like telling my students that, you know, we know that all problems don't have solutions. I mean, but really, we also know that all solutions lead to problems. And the problems associated with the TPP are unusually hairy and large, extremely complex, because we don't know what we don't know. Mm. A lot of it is about the implementation of this agreement. And we wrote several books, George and I, on the black hole of Southeast Asia. That is the lack of information to see whether these agreements, these technical agreements, have been implemented.
So, Henry Kerr, what goods and services are we really talking about when we talk about the TPP? Which industries would be affected?
Sure. So, on the services side, you're thinking about everything from management consulting to financial services, to telecoms being liberalized and removing regulations that might stop U.S. firms from selling overseas and vice versa. On the tariff side, you have reductions in agriculture tariffs, for instance, which will make it easier for American farmers to sell goods overseas and vice versa. And that's received a lot of attention, too.
That seems at first blush like a good thing to make things easier to sell overseas. Where's the concern with pharmaceuticals and being sold overseas?
Well, what it does with pharmaceuticals is it reduces the patent life for certain drugs from 12 to 5. But it does protect biologics. So it's quite complex. Pharmaceuticals, I think, overall are a winner. And so is agriculture, but there are some sectors that are not, and one of them is manufacturing. Manufacturing in the United States is going to be hit very hard.
In what way?
Well, the United States is actually a fairly free and open country in which to invest. And what is happening is the thing that really concerns me about the TPP is the country of origin rules. So, for example, with NAFTA, it's about 65%. That is, you've got to have the parts or the car manufactured, but 65% of the car in that country, in either one of these three countries that are part of the regional agreement. However, with TPP, it's about 42 to 45%.
I'm sorry, 42 to 45% of what?
A country of origin requirements.
A country of origin requirements. And what exactly does that mean?
That means if it's manufactured, 42 or 45% of something is manufactured in one of these 11 countries, which are part of the agreement along with the United States, then it has no tariffs and it has free access to the United States.
Ah, so we're dealing with the complexities of something being made from parts that are from multiple different countries.
Yes, what I'm concerned about is China has already made huge forays and is actually the major trading partner with many of these countries, the major trading partner. And we've written books and provided testimony before Congress on this. China subsidizes. It subsidizes its manufacturing industry, and it subsidizes its steel, and it increases to the tune of about 30% of gross of output of that industry. And it increases these subsidies by 30% or so every year. So, for example, currently the world is awash in cheap Chinese steel. And what would happen is the steel and some of the parts, et cetera, and auto parts especially, would come from China, be manufactured in Vietnam, which we predict is going to be a big winner because of the already low labor wages, and then be exported back to the United States through that route, mm-hmm. wiping out. And I'm very disturbed also by the predictions. You know, I mean, economists rely on these general equilibrium models. And they say, well, in 10 to 30 years, everything will sort itself out and efficiencies will be relocated, et cetera. And my issue with this is it took about 5 years for China to dominate the solar panel industry, 5 years, through heavy subsidies. So we're not talking 10 to 15 years. The time scale has changed.
You know, you mentioned earlier that President Obama has said that, you know, part of his reasoning behind the Trans-Pacific Partnership is to really sort of as a counter to China's rising power internationally, globally, but also in the region. And
right.
How has China responded to the idea of TPP?
Well, actually, China's been fairly open and said we'd like membership down the road. And that's, again, I mean, China has not been in the least bit concerned, although it has expressed some worry and, you know, formal worry. And the reason is there are already arrangements in place. China provides a lot of the materials, steel, for example, or glass. It's heavily subsidized in China, manufactured in these countries, and then in that fashion circumvent any of the tariff barriers or scrutiny.
Can I just hop in on that point?
Sure, of course. Henry Kerr.
So one of the objectives of the president with the TPP is that when you're dealing with deals where you're having to write essentially global regulatory rules and global regulatory standards such that companies can compete internationally, the administration, I think, views it as important to be the first ones there, the first ones to write the rules of global trade. And I think the idea with the TPP is that if you have this deal now, which China then feels that it needs to get in on later, then they're going to have to sign up to the rules that have been already negotiated. And so some of the things that Usha was talking about there, such as China's subsidies to its industries, would be harder to do under the TPP, which includes rules restricting that. So that's one of the kind of political advantages of getting in there first. I think the fear is that if the TPP failed, then China is writing its own kind of alternative Pacific free trade agreement and would be able to write these things in with laxer standards. So I think the administration's keen to kind of write the rules of the game.
Mm. Well, let me interject here. China already is part of the WTO, so it's not supposed to subsidize its industry. It continues to do so. As a matter of fact, it has increased subsidies to these industries. And while we fight through the system to stop those subsidies, China, meanwhile, continues to ramp up those subsidies, and those industries and interests that are affected literally die. because it takes about 3 to 5 years to go through the system. The TPP doesn't make things more efficient, doesn't make bureaucracy more efficient. And so China has a way. We build a better mousetrap, better mousetrap, and China becomes a smarter mouse. And that has occurred time and time and time again. And yes, there are some advantages to being a first mover. However, international business is littered with first movers. the corpses of first movers. So there are also huge disadvantages. In my opinion, there are some advantages to this TPP, and some of these have been mentioned. However, there are also huge disadvantages and very large risks. And so it isn't a clean win by any means.
Let's go. We're talking this hour about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a complicated trade agreement between the U.S. and 11 other countries, Pacific Asian countries, including Canada and Mexico, New Zealand, Japan, amongst others. And we're talking this hour about the details of the agreement, why it's drawn so much criticism from both sides, both Democrats and Republicans, and why President Obama feels it so important to pass the agreement, to ratify the agreement before the end of the year. You can call us with your question or comment at 651-227-6000, or you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. Again, that's 651-227-6000, or toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. You can also reach us online with your comment or question at nprnews.org/live. Let's go to the phone. We've got David on the line in St. Paul. David, welcome.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I would like your guest to address or look at the address the investor to state dispute settlements, or how the rules or laws of this TPP would be enforced. It's my understanding that they completely bypass any government regulations. They bypass all government regulations. So and this is on display, and it also doesn't go through the traditional government judicial systems. It's the corporations that are writing these laws and enforcing them. An example of this is the Keystone Pipeline. There, you know, the Keystone Group is suing the United States for $15 million currently, or $15 billion for loss of profits or potential loss of profits. So this totally undermines our democratic policies of enforcing rules or regulations, and also, the citizens of these countries have no say in these rules. Thank you.
All right, David, thanks so much for your call. So yes, ISDS, this has become a key issue. Senator Elizabeth Warren specifically has spoken out loudly about the ISDS and the fact that this is something that could have a negative effect on the United States sovereignty. Usha Haley, help us to understand how ISDS works.
I'm not a lawyer, and Elizabeth Warren is. I'm just an academic, but I do know that there is a very, very big bias towards corporatism in these dispute settlement mechanisms. So, yes, corporations can sue the government if they figure their profits are being hurt. However, marginalized groups, labor, indigenous groups, environmentalists cannot sue corporations. And so there is this skewed understanding of profits. And I have been dealing with manufacturing groups that have been affected by trade, and they don't really have the deep pockets that corporations do. Environmentalists don't, neither do those indigenous groups that are worried about, for example, gas pipelines going through their land. And so there is a redistribution of power to those that already have it from those that do not.
Henry Kerr, the White House has said that there are already about 3,000 trade deals around the world with ISDS provisions, 50 that the U.S. is involved in already. And the U.S. has faced 13 ISDS cases, has never lost, at least not so far. Is this ISDS something that the Americans should be worried about?
So I think there's a legitimate problem here, which is that if you're going to have regulations at an international level, such that people can play on the same playing field across countries, then you're going to have some kind of international dispute resolution mechanism to deal with the fact that things go wrong. And you're right that several of these ISDS, many of these ISDS mechanisms already exist. And these have been used to America's advantage. For instance, there was an ISDS case against a province of Canada, which expropriated a paper mill from a U.S. company. And the U.S. Company was able to get some compensation. So these things go both ways. I also think it's important to note that a lot of the critics who come out against the ISDS are also people who tend to oppose freer trade in general, and they kind of latch onto the ISDS as something that's going to be politically unappealing. So, for instance, you can criticize the fact that corporations take part in the ISDS, but when you're talking about cross-border business deals, of course it's going to be corporations who are involved in those disputes. So I think there are legitimate questions, particularly around transparency, about how to resolve these disputes. But I don't think it should be particularly shocking to anyone that you need some kind of international way to resolve a regulatory dispute that results from harmonizing regulations across borders.
Speaking of transparency, initial negotiations over the TPP's terms were conducted in secret. Well-connected interest groups had more access and influence than the general public. Should that be of concern, Henry?
Well, the thing about negotiations is that, these things are very politically sensitive. And people take negotiating positions, which they then row back from. I think we can see now how it can be very difficult for politicians to come out with a very harsh line on something and then try to row back. You can see how that's affecting Donald Trump with some of his rhetoric on immigration and so on. So personally, I don't really see the problem with negotiations happening in private, so long as once the deal is out, it's then subject to plenty of public scrutiny, as indeed the TPP is clearly getting.
Yeah, but it's been fast-tracked so that there doesn't need to be any debate over it once it gets into Congress for a final vote.
So the fast-track Trade Promotion Authority was the necessary part of the deal being negotiated. But you can see now that the administration's very worried that the TPP will not, in fact, make it through Congress, with both presidential candidates opposing the deal and plenty of opposition in Congress. And I think that the fact that the TPP is getting such scrutiny on shows like this, and the fact that there's significant concern that it won't make it through because it still does need to be approved by a vote of Congress, shows that, you know, democracy is functioning on this issue. I don't think you can really claim there's a deficit there.
Mm-hmm. But however, despite there is a lack of transparency, so despite it, the TPP being some sort of foray into protectionist measures, there is a lot of deal making and provision adding in this legislative canvas.
Mm-hmm. So,
which we don't know about, so that's doubly concerning.
How much would the U.S. be affected by the agreement in terms of fulfilling the requirements of the TPP? Would it require any major changes to our current trade practices?
We're already a fairly open country, so the people are exporting. It's just going to reduce tariffs. So it's actually, they've done some, I think the ITC released a study a couple months ago which showed that the trade imbalance might actually grow because we will be importing more from these countries. So they have access to our market and we have access to theirs, but their markets are much smaller than ours.
Well, but don't we already have trade agreements with most of these countries anyway?
Yes, we do, but it will reduce tariffs.
So even further than tariffs were reduced with the previous agreements.
Exactly.
But the main liberalizations are not, in fact, on tariffs. So if you look, for instance, at car exports, the progress. So some of the emerging countries like Vietnam and Malaysia are dropping their tariffs on cars some way, and that will help American exporters. But if you look at American exports into Japan of cars, then a lot of the barriers there are regulatory. It's that there are different safety standards for American cars than there are for Japanese cars. And some of those are getting relaxed. Japan's saying it will recognize some of the American regulatory standards. So that's the kind of liberalization that can take place.
However, non-tariff barriers are extremely difficult to get at. And in Japan, for example, the non-tariff barriers deal with the length of the distribution chain and the retail chain. And these are not, the TPP just does not have the mechanisms to get at that. So those will continue, and that gets to the heart of the TPP. These are emerging markets for the most part, except for Japan, New Zealand, Australia. And the quality of information, the quality of regulatory information, et cetera, is very, very poor. So we will not even be able to know whether it's being effectively implemented for a very long time. It could be years before we even know that, if we know it at all.
So do we have any understanding of how big the economic benefits would be then from this trade agreement?
The economic benefits are those that are traditionally argued by economists, which is we're going to have a larger free market, efficiencies will be realized, etc. But economic logic fails in the new reality, in the new world in which we live, in which China is the largest manufacturer and exporter in the world. This is an emerging market. And economic arguments fail about free markets and market-setting prices fail when you have monopolies, negative externalities, and subsidies. And all of these exist here. There are some innovative things in this TPP. I think the first trade agreement to look at state-owned enterprises, for example, has received pushback from Malaysia. If China joins that, it's unlikely to be able to alter its state-owned enterprises to that level. What will happen is that the other countries will lower theirs to China's level. In China, the power of the state is growing. I think the age when trade negotiations and trade policies and agreements such as this enhanced American influence is gone. I mean, the United States remains the largest market, single largest market for so many products, but it is also the largest debtor country, and it's in debt to China, and the infrastructure here is poor. And so our influence is of a different kind now, and this is a different age. So I do think, rather than rushing in, you know, like fools where angels fear to tread, it behooves us to just sort of step back a little bit and take it a bit easy. There is really no rush other than Obama's legacy.
Let me paint a more optimistic picture.
Sure thing, Henry.
The most sophisticated estimates of the economic benefit TPP say that it will push up American incomes by about 0.5% of GDP. Now that's not a very big number. It tells you that that the gains from liberalizing trade are getting ever smaller because trade's already pretty liberalized.
Yeah, but David, 0.5% over what period?
I think that's the long run gain that the model projects. So the issue is
that you inevitably in the last
trade deal.
Let's let Henry finish here, Usha.
Trade deals have shown, while economists broadly agree that reducing trade barriers will boost everybody's incomes, there are concentrated costs on those who are displaced from their jobs as a result of having to face foreign competition. And it's clear that the U.S. hasn't done nearly enough to help those people when it comes to past trade agreements. And I think there are legitimate fears that the people who lost as a result of the TPP, because there would be some of them, that they wouldn't be helped enough either. And I think that's a legitimate concern.
All right. We're talking this hour about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Joining me this hour is Usha Haley, West Virginia University, and Henry Kerr, U.S. Economics Editor for The Economist. We're also taking your calls. If you'd like to join us, you can call at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. Or toll free at 1-800-242-2828. You can also join us online at nprnews.org/live. Let's go to the phones. We've got Jennifer on the line in Stillwater. Jennifer, welcome to the conversation.
Hi. Yeah. I just wanted to say that the TPP is not a free trade bill. It's a corporate rights bill, and it's going to nullify and render moot things like the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act that was supposed to be Obama's signature thing to get women fair pay, because and it's not going to protect the rights of gays, women, minorities, like workers' rights, safety rights, environmental laws like clean air, clean water, pesticides that would be legal in Bangladesh or something could, be used, because it just renders moot like the national, it goes above national sovereign laws. So, and it brings it down to the lowest common denominator signatory countries, and what their laws are, which they don't have good laws. So, not to mention what you guys said, where TransCanada is suing the U.S. because of the tar sands oil pipeline, which, we're a sovereign country. A corporation should not be able to sue us.
All right, Jennifer, thanks so much for your comment. Henry Kerr, how do you respond?
So this is obviously an issue in trade in general, that regulations on environmental standards and on labour standards differ across countries. What you can say for the TPP is that of any trade deal that's been negotiated before, it does the most on those points. So, for instance, on labour standards, it requires that signatories have minimum labour standards in line with the standards put forward by the International Labour Organization. Now, it's probably not going to be enough for a lot of left-wing campaigners, but the TPP is doing more on those fronts that the caller mentioned than past trade deals have.
But what teeth does the TPP have when it actually comes to enforcing these rules? I mean, what can we learn from past incidents and past trade agreements when it comes to somebody being in violation? How, you know, who's responsible for enforcing?
That's an excellent question.
Yeah.
We don't really know.
I'm not certain precisely about the enforcement of the environmental and labour regulations. I believe under past trade deals, the US has brought a case against Guatemala on labour standards in past deals. But I'm not an expert on the enforcement of that specific provision.
Well, the thing is that this covers 40% of world GDP, this deal.
Right.
It's the largest trade deal in history. So our tiffs with Guatemala are really very, very small compared to this deal. And it's extremely complex. And ultimately, I don't see how we could enforce labor regulations and wages. I mean, Vietnam's minimum pay is 56 cents per hour. It's almost impossible to stop, for example, child labor, environmental degradation, some of the other things that the caller mentioned.
So what can we learn from NAFTA and other past trade agreements? What are the lessons here that we should be really thinking about as we move forward? I understand that the TPP is more complex than these past trade agreements, but how has NAFTA affected the U.S. economy? Is it would you say it's been a success, Henry Kerr?
Well, NAFTA, without a doubt, has made the economy overall richer. It's increased trade flows. Meant that companies can have much more efficient cross-border supply chains. It's kept prices low. I think the main lesson of NAFTA and also increased trade with China is that those workers who have been displaced from their jobs as a result of the trade deals have not been helped very much. And recent economic research has documented how, contrary to the predictions of a lot of economists, the workers who were displaced by trade with China found it difficult to find other jobs, despite the fact that unemployment overall remained low. Workers find it difficult to transition, and they're not given a lot of support. I mean, there's a trade adjustment assistance program, but not very much is spent on it, and it doesn't prove to be much of a help to many people. So the main lesson, in my opinion, of the past trade deals is you have to think a lot harder about how to harness the benefits that these trade deals inevitably bring, but also ensure that that those people who bear the kind of concentrated costs are adequately helped out.
Usha Haley?
I actually agree with Henry on this one. I think NAFTA overall has benefited the United States. I think we wouldn't have an auto industry without NAFTA. So I do think that there are groups that have been displaced. I think we are unable to handle things like Chinese subsidies or China's state capitalism and its view on the world and the scale at which it operates. And this is not just a little loophole. It's a truck driving through the barn. I mean, this is a huge way for China to get in and get into our markets. And it doesn't take 10 years for these markets to reach equilibrium. It'll happen in 5 years. It'll happen in less than 5 years in some industries. We are not going to be able to support the people who've been displaced, whose jobs are lost, not because of any efficiencies, but because of things like subsidies. And so this is the danger of dealing with emerging markets. We really don't know what we don't know about them. We don't have the information to make rational decisions, to make strategic decisions. And the more complex it gets, the more repercussions there are. So I'm that's the major reason why I am against the TPP, and I don't think we have the net benefits that we claim.
Trade very frequently gets a bad reputation because the costs are so concentrated.
Right.
But you have to place it in the context of the fact that furnishing a house costs exactly the same in dollar terms as it did in the mid-80s. Clothes are as cheap as they were then. And that a lot of the benefits of these cheap goods that America has been able to import have flowed to lower-income people who spend a higher proportion of their incomes on such things. So you always have to remember that the benefits from trade can be very, very good things, and the challenge for societies is how to distribute them correctly. And I'm not sure I agree with Usha when she says, you know, we wouldn't necessarily be able to help people who are displaced. I think the barriers to that are mainly political. But you have to realize that a trade barrier is a form of redistribution. It's a form of redistribution to the industries that you're protecting away from everyone else, away from the consumers who would benefit from lower prices. So you have to ask yourself, are you willing to tolerate that kind of redistribution? And why not let trade flourish, but instead help out those people who lose?
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Marianne Combs. In this hour, we're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership with Usha Haley of West Virginia University and Henry Kerr, who's a U.S. economics editor for The Economist. We will take your questions or comments when you call 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. Or you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. You can also submit your comment or question online at mprnews.org/live. We'll get back to those comments in just a moment, but first it's time for an update from the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom with Phil Picardi.
Good morning, Marianne. An explosion has rocked the SpaceX launch site in Florida. NASA says SpaceX was test firing its unmanned rocket when the blast occurred. Buildings several miles away shook from the blast, and multiple explosions continued for several minutes. The rocket was scheduled for launch Saturday, carrying an Israeli satellite. Residents in some low-lying communities in Florida are being asked to evacuate as Tropical Storm Hermine approaches the Gulf Coast. The National Hurricane Center expects Hermine to become a hurricane before it makes landfall in Florida's Big Bend area tonight or early tomorrow. The Tallahassee Democrat newspaper says officials in Franklin County have issued a mandatory evacuation notice for people living on St. George Island, Dog Island, Alligator Point, and Bald Point. A lawyer for John Hinckley says he will leave a psychiatric hospital to live full-time in Virginia on September the 10th. Hinckley shot President Ronald Reagan 35 years ago. A judge ruled in July Hinckley was no longer a danger to himself or others and could leave St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington to live with his mother. Hinckley was found not guilty by reason of insanity in the 1981 shooting of Reagan, his press secretary James Brady, and two law enforcement officers outside a Washington, D.C. hotel. Ford says sales of its new cars and trucks fell 8% in August compared to last August. Overall, industry sales are expected to slip 5%, according to J.D. Power and LMC Automotive. And the Air Force says four Georgia-based pilots are restricted from flight duties after their military jets swooped low over a football stadium in Charlotte, North Carolina, as the Carolina Panthers practiced. Panthers coach Ron Rivera said the pilots wave to us as they went over. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:39.
Stay tuned. Coming up at 10 o'clock, we're going to be talking about international adoption. International adoption rates have dropped drastically over the last 11 years, and some countries have banned international adoption altogether. We're going to take a look at why. That's coming up at 10.
Programming is supported by Parent Aware Ratings. Because up to 90% of brain development happens before age 5, parents use Parent Aware Ratings to find childcare using kindergarten readiness best practices. ParentAwareRatings.org.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Marianne Combs, in for Carrie Miller this hour, talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. President Obama has said he'd like to get this through at the end of, have a vote after the presidential elections in November, during the lame duck session before the end of the year. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said, no, there's no way I'm going to allow a vote this year before the end of the year. This hour, we're talking about what exactly is going on with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, why it has been a source of such contention, worries, pros and cons as we look at the global market and these sorts of international trade deals that are getting more and more complex. Joining me is Usha Haley from West Virginia University and Henry Kerr. He's the U.S. economics editor for The Economist. He's in Washington, D.C. Let's go straight to the phones. We've got Josh on the line in Minneapolis. Josh, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, Marianne. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely.
I work at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy here in Minneapolis, where we've been working on analyzing trade agreements for over 30 years. And you've alluded to it a little bit on your program, but I'd like to make very clear that when we talk about non-tariff barriers to trade, we're talking about any law that's passed at the local, state, or federal level in one of the party countries that conflicts with a corporate interest. Mm-hmm. And there's two examples I'd like to give you. The first is labeling for food. There was a recent World Trade Organization ruling that said country of origin labeling laws in the United States for meat were a barrier to trade because apparently knowing which country your meat comes from infringes on corporate profits. Mm-hmm. Now, if we think about seafood in the South China Sea, which is often caught in outright slave labor conditions, stored in less than sanitary conditions for weeks at a time and then shipped to the United States, under the TPP, it would likely be illegal to have a label saying this was caught in Vietnam. The other one is climate change. IATP is about to launch a paper that's going to show how the TPP undermines each individual country's commitments under the Paris Climate Agreement. This is specifically relates to agricultural emissions and energy production. The thing about trade policy is that international trade agreements often undermine all sorts of other global priorities that the U.S. or other countries may have, whether it's climate change or whether it's global health. So it's really important to think about this in the big picture and about how broadly, trade agreements can overrule laws and other agreements that are passed at the local and international levels.
But Josh, President Obama has said that part of this trade agreement, and it's tougher than past agreements, about things like child labor or slave labor, that these are things that would not be allowed under the TPP. So how would that work? You're saying that the seafood production they wouldn't allow us to know where it's coming from. But wouldn't President Obama's regulations, the rules in the TPP trump that?
Well, the history of enforcement of labor and environmental policy and trade agreements is pretty abysmal. I think the Colombia Free Trade Agreement is a really good example of that. The May 10th Accords, by any sort of independent NGO examination, were far from met. So I think that's one thing. The other thing is, the problem with the process. Because corporate advisors were at the table, the agreement it's impossible for it not to serve their interest.
Okay.
May I have a go at that?
Sure. Thank you.
We simply do not have the personnel to enforce that. Currently, the FDA, for example, inspects just one out of 100 shipments that come in. So we just simply do not have the manpower.
Okay. Josh, thanks for your call. Usha, retired Brigadier General John Adams has written that by facilitating more offshoring of America's manufacturing, the trade pact would actually undermine America's military readiness, that it would make the U.S. vulnerable to major disruptions in the supply chain. What do you think of this argument?
I think that's absolutely true. Because we don't know where the supply chain would lead. I'm currently writing a book on the rare earth supply chain and how vulnerable we are because China manufactures produces over 90% or 95% of the rare earths, which are central to our defense supply chain. And so this would affect other components as well. We just lose control over critical parts of our national security.
Henry Kerr, how is the Trans-Pacific Partnership likely to affect trade negotiations with the European Union or the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is still being worked on?
Sure. Well, TTIP is an agreement that, like the TPP, is seeking to harmonize regulations, reduce non-tariff barriers to trade, and so on. So I think that the main thing is that we've seen how politically controversial these kind of issues are when you're trying to harmonize cross-border regulations and when you're trying to set up dispute mechanisms for when it goes wrong. So I think the lesson is really a political one, that these deals might not be as sellable as the politicians who initially started negotiating them thought. And TTIP is pretty controversial in Europe too.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Bob on the line in Mendota Heights. Bob, welcome to NPR News.
Yeah, good morning. You know, one of the traditional ways of judging a trade agreement, I think, is does it expand trade worldwide or does it shift trade into favored partners? Given the fact that we're trying to isolate, one of the goals of the TPT is trying to isolate China or at least neutralize China, how does that play into it on that criteria?
All right, Bob, thanks for your question. Henry, do you want to take a stab at that?
So the TPP would certainly increase global trade flows. I think I'm not exactly sure what it would do to China's trade flows. So critics on the left, I think, would say that the country of origin requirements that Usha was talking about earlier mean that China would benefit slightly, but most of the trade benefits would flow to the countries in the deal. So if you look specifically at services, for instance, then two-thirds of the increase in trade and services that result from the deal is projected to flow to the United States.
Hmm. Well, it's the deals, the gains to China are going to be indirect. But I think it's fairly indicative of these gains that the White House has stopped justifying the TPP on economic grounds and has moved to geopolitical and national security grounds. What it's saying is that the United States should be an active trade partner in this region, keep alive, keep its presence there. And that also doesn't make very much sense because the United States has always been in that region. The Seventh Fleet is there. The United States is a major trading partner and has one-on-one trade deals with many of these countries, except maybe just a handful like Malaysia, which are rather small economies, really, New Zealand. So it's the Obama administration has noticed that it's becoming very, very difficult to justify the TPP on economic grounds. Economics works with ceteris paribus assumptions, that is, everything else being equal. But everything else is far from equal here. As Henry's pointed out, the politics matter, the regulation matters, the non-tariff barriers matter, the dispute resolution matters. And all of these things take place at multiple levels in these countries.
Usha Haley, the TPP has recently received so much negative attention from both presidential candidates as well as from Mitch McConnell. Can President Obama really still push this agreement through?
I think he's going to try in a lame duck session, but it becomes really awkward and clumsy because Hillary Clinton now says she opposes it, although she was in favor of it earlier, and her economic advisors are all pro-TPP people. So it's I think it becomes pretty much a balancing act here. I don't see how he could do it.
Hmm. So you're not
if
so
it
worried.
Does go through the...
Henry?
I was just going to say, if it does go through the lame duck session under... a president-elect Hillary Clinton, it will be primarily with Republican votes, mm-hmm. and they will then need some Democrats to also support it. So it really depends how responsive those Democrats are to the president-elect's entreaties to oppose it. And so we don't know, having won the election, precisely, you know, how much a President Clinton or indeed a President Trump would lobby Congress to oppose the TPP. And that's kind of the crucial factor, I think, from the political side.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that key to the passing of the TPP is Republican congressmen who are not up for re-election, who have nothing to lose at this point, and that mm-hmm. President Obama would be relying on them for votes right now.
Yep.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, the Republicans in Congress are the more free trade party. So of the people who are not up for re-election, they're the more likely to be voting yes. I mean, I'm sure there are some Democrats who are not up for re-election who are likely to oppose the deal too. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it cuts both ways.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Daniel on the line in Fridley. Daniel, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Whenever I whenever I hear the word America in this discussion, I substitute corporate interests. And corporations aren't concerned about borders or American interests. And the other point I have is I understand that nobody's ever read the TPP. So how can you make statements that the TPP will do this or it won't do that?
All right, Daniel.
Talk about transparency.
Yep. Thank you for your conversation, for your comment. Usha, who has access to the TPP as it stands now to read it?
Well, Congress should have some aspects. The ITC does, about 6,000 technical pages. I know a couple of lawyers who've read it, but the ordinary public doesn't have access to it.
That's
a very good question.
Henry Kerr, is that a problem?
Well, there's been a lot of analysis of the terms done. I'm not familiar with exactly who has access and who doesn't.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, are critics of the TPP perhaps just reticent to recognize new realities of a global economy, that things are just complicated and are going to continue to be complicated, Henry Kerr?
Well, this is exactly the question. I think a lot of callers have raised good points about the fact that, you know, it's uncomfortable for nation states to have these supranational bodies who are empowered. But ultimately, you've got to make a decision as a society, which is how much do you want American car makers to be able to sell cars to Japan? Because if you want that to happen, then America and Japan are going to have to cooperate under the regulations. And let's be honest, the kind of people who are selling cars to Japan are big corporations. They're inevitably going to be involved in the process. They're inevitably going to be the ones who have disputes when it goes wrong. So, you know, I think there's a lot of, you know, banning about the word corporations as though it's a bad word. But these, you know, the drivers of the American economy, we know that export facing jobs, jobs where people are selling goods to other countries, pay on average about 18% more than other jobs. So if you create more of those by increasing your export markets, then a lot of workers are going to do better. But I think it's right that to ask questions about how to properly coordinate this kind of stuff about across borders. And there is a bit of a trade-off between sovereignty and economic integration there. And people have to decide what's most important.
Usha Haley?
I think Henry's raised some really good points. I think corporations know their interests better than most groups do, other indigenous people and environmentalists do. They can identify. The auto industry in the United States is actually opposing the TPP. It's the Japanese automakers that are supporting it because they have access to the U.S. market. So they are earmarked to be among the big winners. So it's even there, it's not very clear. I mean, I can see Henry's argument. But the auto industry doesn't think it's going to be benefiting hugely from it. One of the callers raised a really good question. Who has actually read the TPP? We're relying on analysis. And I think one of the first points would be, I'm an academic, go out and read the original and see what's going on. And my fear is I wouldn't be able to understand it anyway, because it's going to be 6,000 pages, I'm told, of technical stuff.
So what happens if the TPP doesn't go through? I mean, what's the likelihood of us not coming up with some sort of trade agreement down the road with these countries, Henry Kerr?
Well, it's very hard to forecast the political landscape, you know, 5-10 years out. You know, I think if the TPP fails, that's free trade, a big free trade in that deal in that area done for a while. I mean, Donald Trump has promised more bilateral trade deals. I don't know if he's serious about that or not. But I think it's clear that there has been a bit of a shift on the politics of trade. And if TPP fell, that would signify, you know, that would be a pretty bad sign for the prospect for free trade going forwards in terms of how easy it is to get these kind of deals through Congress. So I wouldn't be optimistic. In terms of what changes, I mean, not much, because the TPP is the thing that would change the economic landscape. So you wouldn't harness the economic benefits from TPP. At the same time, you wouldn't face the concerns that plenty of your callers seem to have.
Usha Haley.
Well, I think bilateral agreements are probably the way to go in this brave new world that we're in, because the TPP does, I do agree that it does benefit some industries, but the risks are huge. The unknowns are even bigger. And the groups that are affected to the extent to where they could be wiped out without any possibility for any reparations. And so at this point in time, where we really do feel fairly vulnerable, I don't think a leap into the unknown, which of this scale, is really warranted.
Mm-hmm. Pat, let's go to the phones. We've got Pat in Sleepy Eye. Pat, welcome to NPR News. Thanks for joining the conversation.
Well, thank you very much. I've been listening for the last 55 minutes, and of that 55 minutes, I can tell you that about, maybe a very few seconds have been talked about on how this TPT could benefit the ag economy in Minnesota. You've got to understand that, you know, when we drive around Minnesota, it doesn't matter if it's Minneapolis or out in southern Minnesota, northern, every town has an elevator in it. Our ag economy in Minnesota is slowly trickling into the tank. And so we need everything possible that will boost prices, then of commodities, getting the land prices back where they're supposed to be. We're going to be in a farm ag crisis in a very short time. So in my work, I look for everything I can to see where the people I work for can improve their prospects. So
Pat, what do you think of the TPP?
It's a very high level discussion, obviously. So I don't think you're going to be able to get this by too many people who really want to talk about it or think about it. I like the TPP, if it helps the ag economy.
If it helps the ag economy. Okay. Pat, thanks for your call. Usha, does
it help some sectors?
It does help some sectors?
Yes, it does. Chickens, for example, exporters of chicken, exporters of soybean. It helps some sectors of the agricultural economy. Cargill is a big supporter of the TPP.
Mm-hmm.
And beef as well. Beef is a
big one.
A lot of American producers have said it would help them grow their export markets overseas. I'd say on balance, agriculture is one of the winning industries from the TPP in the U.S.
Yes, that's true.
We have just a minute left, and I just want to reiterate that we've been talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which it involves 12 countries, including the United States, Canada, and Mexico, as well as a host of Pacific Asian countries like Japan and New Zealand. We are not the only country that has to ratify this agreement. Do we know where it stands with the other 11 countries? Usha?
Well, some of the countries are huge supporters. Others have vocal opposition like we do. So it really depends. The Japanese have their opposition. Even in Australia, there's opposition. But most of them have more clear-cut gains than the United States does. The United States has some gains for some industries, for example, with the telecom or technology or computers. Mm-hmm. Intel, for example, is a big supporter because it won't have to release its code, source code. But some of the others, the countries, they have their oppositions. I'm not really that familiar with the process, but it's not an unmixed blessing anywhere.
All right.
It's also the case that the politics is more volatile here, because it being a presidential election year, I'd say.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true.
Usha Haley in Morgantown, West Virginia, and Henry Kerr in Washington, D.C., thanks so much to both of you for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
And one last comment online. They say the TPP is available to the public, published in full. It's just full of legalese and rather difficult to read. So that's from one of our online commenters. Thanks so much for joining us this hour for the conversation.
ClimateCast is supported by Benjamin Franklin Plumbing. Together with Mike Rowe, Benjamin Franklin Plumbing supports skilled plumbers who have the tools and expertise to get the job done right the first time. Ben Franklin Plumbing, the punctual plumbers, 877-BEN-1776. Education reporting on NPR News is funded in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.